you have that stage where when you know nothing, you feel like you kind of know everything, right? Like, I'm like learning things, I'm studying things. I'm like, I think I know a lot. And then you actually like get into it and you realize like, I actually don't.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the co-founder and CEO at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Devin O'Brien from Cordis.io, and we're going to talk about I would say it's not a business fad, business fashion. It's a recent thing that you hear is popular, which is productized services. And a productized service is somewhere between software and a service, and it combines ideally the best pieces of both. And Devin has managed to build a success story around this and productizing the services around his fractional CFO firm. So Devin, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could just kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yes, thank you for having me. So something not many people know about me. When I was in college, I had some really great professors. And throughout my finance career, I've always known in the back of my head, and I never talked to people about it, that my dream job after working in financial services, so I think in my 40s, 50s, and beyond, is to be a finance professor. I love teaching, and I've loved kind of being in some of those classes and seeing the good ones versus the bad ones. And I just think there's something that about me that will just never want to retire and will want to be a professor or lecturer for as long as I can do it. And that's something I never really talk about.
Okay, very cool. So there's a thread in what you're saying there, because you graduated from Penn. Now, maybe for non-US listeners, I think we've all heard of Penn State. It's very prestigious as far as I know. So just tell us, how did you get in there? Is it tough to get in, and where did that lead you in your career?
Yeah, it's I wouldn't say it's the one of the toughest. It's not like an Ivy League school here. They do have a prestigious finance and business program. So actually, when I decided to go to Penn State, I grew up in Pennsylvania. So being in Pennsylvania, very common for at least to take a college visit. And when I was there, I was actually thinking about majoring in supply chain and logistics. And Penn State had one of the top schools in the country for supply chain and logistics. From there, I took my first class in that, said, nope, this is not what I want to do. I don't think it's interesting at all. And so then, you know, they just had a GPA requirement and then an application process. They have a little bit of a different program where in order to double major in accounting and finance at Penn State, you have to get a master's in accounting. So I decided that, you know, I had good grades and I wanted to apply for this program that you could be selected to with 100 students to go into that program. So that's how I ended up deciding. Really was just trial and error and what I liked and what I thought I was good at, and then found myself in accounting and finance.
Okay, let me just circle back on the supply chain and logistics thing, because granted, not known for its glamorous lifestyles, let's say, but as someone who, you know, has many, you know, logistics customers and so on, I mean, it's not for everyone, right? So everyone fits. But what did you think it was going to be, and what put you off that career?
Yeah, I think it was in that initial class, I think I thought really it was a lot about, like, in my understanding, was trying to like optimize logistics and focusing on reducing variances and lead times and costs and materials. And originally when I was there, it was just a lot of like blanket supply chain terminology. And maybe I just didn't give it enough chance. But it felt like I was in that class and I was more just trying to memorize terms for an exam. And I didn't feel like I had any general understanding of like what those terms and everything were doing that made businesses better. And I was like, what is this value right now? It felt like so minimal. It was like memorizing terms. And I just didn't see, again, I thought there was just a delta between what I thought there would be this like massive understanding of business and logistics and value. And obviously it was very early on at Penn State, so I wasn't deep into the weeds of supply chain, but it just didn't have that intrigue, and it didn't get me, you know, stimulated into a flow state.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I've done my share of procurement training as Incoterms and taxes and like a lot of it's, let's face it, a lot of it is how the sausage actually gets made isn't that glamorous. So I can understand.
Yes.
And then you went, but you took a considerably, what might some might say, more glamorous path, which is an M&A for large companies with KPMG. So what did you learn from that time in your life career?
Yeah, really the reason I wanted to get into that was I had done an audit internship my sophomore year of college, didn't really find that too interesting. And there was actually a keynote speaker at Penn State, I'm going to blank on the name, but he was the former CEO of Oracle. And I remember he asked me, because I was there early, he was waiting to speak. We started talking and he had said, you know, like audit and tax, like just think 10, 20 years out, this is all going to be automated, right? Like this is going to be so redundant. Well, I don't think that is going to happen in that time. I do think there is a lot of redundancy.
And here so we what are. I saw 10 years
yeah, later, exactly. still here. Yeah, exactly. But what I, you know, what I thought was interesting about M&A was instead of having, you know, like we go into an audit and here's our processes and here's what we do. And it felt like you're kind of just pick up and do those same things. And again, maybe like a little bit boring in my mind. I was always on like different deals. So it was always like something new, a different business, a different complexity, has, you know, foreign subsidiaries. There was always something new that I felt like I was constantly learning and challenging myself. And it was never like a dull moment. And I think that was, it wasn't really like anything glamorous or how I kind of fell into M&A. It was my just thought process being this college kid who didn't really know much about it of like, well, if I'm working on like five deals at once, it's got to be fast paced. I always have to be learning and it has to be very interesting. And that was exactly what I found. And that's when I was like, I really actually enjoy this work.
So these were large deals, right? International deals.
Yep.
When it came to tax. Does that mean, was this figuring out, for example, like in an international deal, there's often a tax is a big motivator sometimes. It might be the only motivator. I'm not sure. Maybe you can tell me about that. Did you get a chance to travel during that? And how did you, because no one, well, it's hard to get people who are qualified in all the different jurisdictions. So does that mean, how do you even figure that out? How do you keep it straight when they're so complicated?
Yeah. So to your original question, we did do, it was kind of a mix, right? So we'd have some solely, you know, US-based companies, and we really were then just the only party involved, the KPMG involved in, it was a combination usually like on the buy side of looking for potential tax exposures, then a lot about like efficient structuring, right? Like, should we acquire this as an asset, a stock? Should we, you know, drop this subsidiary into this? It was a lot about just tax efficient structuring and then looking for exposures, kind of similar to how in a quality of earnings, right? You're looking for financial exposures. And so we oftentimes, you know, to your point, we had to bring in multiple different locations or, you know, units at KPMG. So we'd be in charge of the US federal. I'd be working with a Canada team. Sometimes, you know, you'd get into a deal and you'd find out, oh, they have a warehouse actually in Mexico. And I would then be going to the directory looking for the partner in Juarez to see if he can look at this to then give me some, you know, information on that. So it was really interesting in the collaboration, to your point, of depending on what that company looked like, buy side, sell side, you were oftentimes working with the Irish team, the Canadian team, the Mexico team, all these different people. And then those people also have different specialties, right? So you're trying to find the person who knows about manufacturing in this, you know, in the Mexico team. So it was really interesting that you're all kind of collaborating and looking at it. And then, you know, you're populating a due diligence report. And then, you know, the different parties are all making their recommendations, but presenting it as one KPMG unit.
Okay. So it sounds, on the one hand, exciting, on the other hand, extremely corporate. Definition of it being in the belly of the beast. You know, what led you to not pursue that career further, and what are you hoping to build with Cordis?
That's a great question. I think when I was there, and if you asked me when I was leaving college, I think I have an older brother who works at KPMG and he's stayed there. He's continued to move up the chain. When I was there, exactly your point, it just felt really corporate. And for me, especially when you're a junior, you're not really making decisions, right? Like you're mostly crunching numbers, you're putting together reports, you're, for lack of better terms, the grunt. And so for me, I kind of felt like, yes, eventually you can continue to move up and you can be that decision maker. But I just felt like there has to be something where I can go do and feel like I'm providing more value and build something on my own. So for me then, it was really just a combination of, I didn't want to kind of be a cog in a wheel. I wanted to actually provide value. And then the other part was, you read books, you listen to podcasts, you just hear about the benefit of building your own business, having equity in your own business. And especially in M&A, you see founders and entrepreneurs who started a business while they were in college with, you know, $15,000. And then I'm putting together a funds flow and I see them making $35 million, $115 million. And you're like, this is life-changing, right? It's hard. I don't know how hard it is, but I thought this is a very interesting challenge. Nobody in my family has done this. And this is something that I'm willing to give it a go because I know that I, with my Penn State, the connections, kind of the all the different people I built. If I ever wanted to go back to that, I could. But would I just regret while I'm young and I could take that chance that I didn't? And that's what really led me to go for it.
Okay. So how did you take that step out? Did you like have an idea who you're going to work for? I'm guessing you can't like ring up Intel and say, hey, I can do some M&A work on the side if you need me. That's not going to work. So how did you get the confidence to step out?
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part is like, you know, you have that stage where when you know nothing, you feel like you kind of know everything, right? Like I'm like learning things, I'm studying things. I'm like, I think I know a lot. And then you actually like get into it and you realize like, I actually don't. And so what really actually started it was during COVID, you know, everyone was remote. I had a little bit of downtime and a few people from, you know, that work at startups in my network had just asked like, hey, over the weekend, could you build me like a financial model? And, you know, the first couple of times you do that, they're all different. You kind of struggle through it. And then you kind of start to gain confidence. You see other models, other templates, and you continue to learn. So it was really like during COVID, using kind of downtime or weekends to do projects, you know, for additional money, but also using it as like, I'm being paid to learn. And that's when I felt comfortable that I'm sharing these files and I'm getting good feedback and people are asking me to continue to do work. This has to be a business opportunity in here.
And were these sort of fundraising models largely for funded startups? Yeah. Okay.
For startups. And I think there was a few that were like merger models and looking at synergies. So I try to do a few different ones, right? It was more of like the challenge of like a merger model is a lot different than a fundraising. So I try to do different ones or find different projects to really just like build my scope of knowledge.
Okay. Well, so far it's all sounding very clean and analytical and prepared. And so, so let's take a hard left turn and tell me about your first real client, if you like, and the issues you were faced with when you did manage to take the jump.
Yeah. So the first real client was a startup that was burning capital. And I think what I, you know, didn't realize is all the complexities, right, of I was just building a financial model for them. And now they want me to just take over the finance and accounting department, right? And I think I was siloed working in professional services that I didn't realize how large that scope could be with the like FP&A work, accounting work, working with the tax team to do tax work. I really first was kind of like searching on YouTube of like, is there things I'm not doing that I should be doing? I didn't realize that there was so much more, especially with a startup that's burning capital, trying to strategize, trying to run scenarios, how much work and constant analysis I would be doing. And that was a real wake-up call for me. And building models and collaborating with people, them not updating things, then us having wrong data. There's so many challenges of like, all right, I'm working with founders who aren't finance people. They don't work in Excel. Like what is it that makes these disconnects? And, you know, then trying to solve all of them kind of live on the fly while this company is like still burning capital and still trying to run through strategies.
I know. It's so weird. Like the spreadsheet works. It works every time I type it in. And then you put that in the real world. And for some reason, it's just different. So so this business was a gym business, as I understand it. And you and me were talking earlier on about Alex Hormozi. He's an influencer online. I think he's a stone cold genius, to be honest, even though he looks like a scary man, great marketer. And he started off in gyms, and he paints this picture of gyms being actually the antithesis of your spreadsheet business. There's a lot of characters involved. There's a lot of handshake deals, very informal, and yet they can scale fast. So what was the situation you were faced with the founding team here when you came into it?
Yeah, so it was really kind of in the beginning, it was kind of classic startup of, hey, we started this. We have a few different founders who are kind of just doing different roles, right? Like no one has like a very defined scope, a very defined role. And there was nobody that had a core finance background. So when I first came in, it was really about, okay, they were going to need to do some fundraising soon. And, you know, the team at the time was obviously aware of that, but they didn't really know everything that was going on in the background. So one of the founders had another business, and obviously the gym business, you know, in the beginning with building improvements, the equipment, you know, it's capital intensive for that initial outlay. And so, you know, one of the founders were moving funds between businesses kind of on an as needed basis. So, you know, pulling from his one business to cover this bill until they got a new fundraising round, we get fundraising, moving money back over and doing all of this in and out. And so when we actually went into the QuickBooks, we realized like, it's never been reconciled. all the bank accounts aren't linked up, all the credit cards aren't linked up, there was no financial controls. So even to raise money, we didn't even, you know, we couldn't even put together a pro forma or show true financials that we felt we could stand behind because it was such a disaster. So we had to come in and then basically get all the bank statements, turn off everybody's access to bank accounts, really, but us and, you know, the main investor then who had hired us. And so we had to kind of like wipe everybody's ability to spend money and then just spend, took about a month and a half trying to get all the different statements, credit cards, everything, and do a deep dive reconciliation process, basically to restate from 2022 on. And then we felt comfortable to really run from there.
Okay, you said something really important there. So you were brought in by the investor. That was, am I wrong in saying that the investor had some idea that maybe not all was well here? He just didn't have confidence aware of what was going on.
And then exactly.
And then one of these founders was using, he had a different entity and he's basically using the cash as if it was all the same, which is, if you were to be not generous about it, you say, well, that's straight up fraud. Like, he's taking money for investment and he's using it for other purposes. So not uncommon. And it's not uncommon for people to just say, okay, let's clear it up. As long as you move along, we won't make a fuss. Is that what happened here?
Yeah. Yeah. So we kind of once everything was squared away, that main investor kind of took like a CFO role with us doing a lot of the work and kind of partnering with him. And so he came in, got everything cleaned up with us, cap table. And then he just was like open and communicated with all the investor base and said, hey, here's what happened. Here's what's going on. Here's the situation we're in. And kind of was just open and transparent about it. And then obviously when they were, you know, removing that founder, it was the conversation was, you know, when you're leaving, you know, you're not getting severance and all these things. And you should be lucky, obviously, that there's not more that's going to happen that we could be doing.
Okay. Well, let's follow up on that later. Cause bringing brought in is kind of investors is a smart move, right? So trying to build relationships there can help with that. So then, okay, so you've cleaned everything up, and then let's talk about my favorite topic, expenses. And when it actually, it's all one thing is the reporting and the legality, keeping everyone out of jail, I guess. But then it's a case of like trying to get that burned down. You mentioned removing access to credit cards and bank statements. What other tooling did you use to sort of allow people to still operate the business without access to these things?
Yeah. So the investor brought us in, you know, we really like as soon as he got involved. So they had some like regional bank accounts. He moved everything over to Mercury. So like startup banking platform. So, you know, he could decide who has access. Basically all the money's here. We're now in control. Those bank accounts, they're going to go to zero. Just leave them. Then we first started using kind of Mercury and just tracking everything there using actually just their debit cards. And then we got approved and started working with Ramp so that then we could get everybody, all their cards and set, you know, limits, require that individuals, you know, request and go through an approval process for higher limits. All AP had multiple approval flows. So we basically said, we're now in control of the bank. We're now in control of all bills and wires and card transactions. So we can see everything that's going on. So if you want to spend on CapEx, you know, that is going to have to get approved. You guys want to pay this bill, do this. Everything has to go through multiple layers of approval. So we have eyes on everything that is going out and it can't go out with us without us knowing.
Okay. So Mercury is not a bank. It's a fintech.
Yes. Fintech. Right? Yes. Yep.
And you know, recently we've had the collapse of Synapse and that led to a number of fintechs getting into trouble. So as a CFO, how do you mitigate, or are you happy to work with companies like that, or how do you manage that risk? Because, you know, it's changing, even politically, it's changing these days. It's hard to know exactly which way things are going, but definitely banking is an issue. Some of these things have gone bang. They do give you very sexy tooling, which is great. So have you thought about that and how do you approach it?
Yeah, I would say, I think that obviously there's definitely more risk and we've thought about that. And I think for us, you know, when I got introduced to Mercury through that investor and I actually hadn't really heard from it, he had done a good amount of due diligence and, you know, obviously seeing some like FDIC insured, you know, for X dollars, X amounts, he felt comfortable and also knew a little bit more about like where the company was financially in terms of like burning and capitalization that he felt good about it. And so to me, I think obviously it's a risk. I think you brought up a really good point for me. I just found that Mercury, although there is that risk, the tool, the abilities, the functionality is so much more modern day. And I have so many more pain points and troubles using a big bank, right? Like I have to log in and do all these things. This wire is not working. Like I don't have those problems with, that I would see with like a PNC, a Chase, and all these other things with Mercury. It's just so much more friendly. And in a startup, when everything's moving fast and you're kind of trying to always just be scrappy and dynamic, I felt like that risk was worth the reward.
Yeah. And, you know, you can pay for an account manager there and then you get the service. Whereas, you know, some of these other banks, you have to know the secret keyword and the secret set of transactions to get any service out of them. It's, yeah, my wife uses them and she's had a very good experience, but they're, you know, you just got to be aware of that, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. So spend control is in place. I like that a lot. I'd like to turn now to this concept of like productized service. So it's a bit of a buzzword. I perceive that this is something you're developing with Cordis. Maybe you can give your take on what it is and why it's a good, why you think it fits with this fractional CFO model.
Yeah. So yeah, the productized service, I think really for us and really where I see it is we're really just leveraging where we are with software, with AI agents, with automations to take a lot of the work that you do either in accounting, bookkeeping, you know, AP, fractional CFO work, and either just automating that task so it can be done faster and more accurate, and then using it also then to obviously AI can help with projections. So for us, the way we're using it really is a collaboration tool with the people that we're working with and with our team so that we can always communicate with them without having to export the three financial statements from QuickBooks, right? A lot of the founders and business owners that we work with, they don't want to go into the accounting system. Is that because they don't like QuickBooks? It's a UI. It's also to them, I found it's their system of record, right? And they're scared to ever go in and mess things up. So for us, it's, this isn't the system of record and we are pulling all this data. So you can still see everything. It's all in one place and we can collaborate with you on here. And that really has been a really big pro to collaborating with clients is we don't have to, they can always look at their financials, right? Once the API is linked up, it kind of gives us that little bit of, we don't always have to meet. You can just look and review and ask questions and we can kind of collaborate through a platform.
So you're using QuickBooks on the back end and then have do you roll your own software to provide dashboards or using some other tooling to provide the dashboards? How are you?
Yep, exactly. So we provide dashboards and then we have the QuickBooks API, so we're pulling their financial statements into our system. We have a spreadsheet functionality so we can do modeling and budgeting on our platform. And so then really like your forecasts and your actuals can all live right in the platform. And then same with like the 13 weeks. So we have an automated 13 week cash flow that is looking at your bank data, can give you an automated forecast that's just, again, looking at the transactions and then running models to see, again, projecting those out for the next 13 weeks. And then you can also manually manipulate it. So really our goal is you're taking your accounting system of record and then we're taking all of that into our platform and then also letting you look at dashboards at your data and forecast. So really kind of all of that lives in one spot.
Okay. So this is where a modern platform like Mercury really comes in because it integrates well. It's live time. It's not a batch process every week or whatever. There's no uploading, downloading. It all just happens.
Exactly. Exactly.
How far do you get that with that? Because, you know, in theory, we have automated some of our accounts, but there always seems to be the dreaded journal entry that needs to be done every, you know, at the end of the month for the special case, things like accruals, capitalization, I guess. What's possible in terms of automation, in terms of not being able to touch the books, client really being able to log in and see times, and how far away are we from that for, let's say, most of your clients?
I think we're still pretty far away. I think you hit on the big ones that I still see issues with is you're looking at vendor wire information, right? And it's sometimes QuickBooks, right? It sees a vendor name and it's wrong. And looking at the wire detail, it picks the wrong vendor. So I don't think that there's going to be the ability to have it be 100% accurate, pull all the right things. But I think you can get to a point where it's getting to that 95, 99, where you're just limiting the amount of time you have to do to review. Or, right, it's doing everything it can. And the things that it's just not sure about, it's leaving to you. Because capitalization, the policies and how people do things, it's going to be different, right? Some people will capitalize things 2,500 and over. Some do 5,000 and over. So I think it will get to that 95 to like, plus percent. I don't think it'll ever get to 100. There is always still that I know this thing. How, you know, if you get an email that says we were supposed to be doing this or accrued interest on this, there's just going to be things where when you're communicating with operators, right, that how are you going to get that in and tell that if an operator doesn't even know how to explain it in accounting terms, right?
The dreaded finance operations gap.
Exactly.
That's where all the problems start. Okay, cool. So you put a lot of effort in, and I want to tell people a little bit now about the success that you've had, because you've put, you know, you think carefully about your tech stack, and this is yielding these benefits. When you see your website as, let's say, a CEO, entrepreneur, operator perspective, it looks really clean. It's speaking the right language, you know, real time, knowing where my business is. I love that. I love that song. I want to join in. So tell me your first 2 years, how is business going, and where do you expect to end up at the end of this year?
Yeah. First year in business, we kind of, I'd say we launched in January of 2023 and then really started to kind of build and scale the team really in like the April, May timeframe. But in that first 8 to 12 months in business, we did just under seven figures. And so now year over year, I think we're going to grow between 100 to 150% in year two. And now we're kind of getting into the place in year three where it's, again, more automations, more systems, and new offerings is really how we are seeing continue to try to achieve 100, 100% growth, you know, year over year.
That's insane. That's like tech startup growth rates for a services company, effectively.
That's what I'm trying for.
All right. Well, maybe you can get the multiples too. Then we're really amazing.
that would be even better.
Okay. So now everyone left listening to us. I don't know how many are left at this stage, but this is the really good stuff because this is the interesting part, right? So you make it sound so easy. You pick the right software, you get the clients, you know, you bring it in, you're scaling really fast. Let me ask about your own practice marketing. So what do you attribute this growth to?
Yeah. So in the beginning, for me, it was really founder-led growth. So being really active on Twitter/X and kind of showing that you're an authority figure in that space. I think in some point in the end of 2022, mid-2022, I was always active on X, but I probably had 20 followers, followed like 1,000 people. It was a mix of sports, business, et cetera. And then I realized and kind of started to see people like Salhi Bloom on Twitter or these other people who were writing threads and kind of showing that they were an authority and building these massive audiences. So really all I started to do was just provide consistent content, kind of just adding value, talking about case studies, things we're doing, things I've seen. And really just from that and doing that consistently over time, I had one or two posts that got, you know, massive hundreds of thousands of views, long form threads on X. And those ones really like exploded my profile and almost made me an authority figure. And then from that, what I noticed is all of the people who would come in through Twitter, the success rate and close rate was just so much higher than any cold outreach that we were doing because they felt like they trusted and knew my, you know, knowledge and I had authority from following me. I'd get on a call and someone would say, I saw your tweet about X and I actually have that problem. And it was like, okay, wow, this sales call is going to be so much easier because they have a problem. They know I know how to solve it. And so like, it's not all, like, I don't have to prove that we can do this. So it was really founder-led growth in the beginning. And then we added Ro Mendoza on our team as a head of growth. And so we did that hire early because Ro's background was in, he was working for a large agency across a wide variety of brands, managing their paid social, growth, everything there. And so he was actually a friend of mine. And I said, hey, why don't you come help us do this because I don't want it to just be founder-led growth. So having someone that like knows a strategy and knows like this is going to work on the software side, this is probably how we really should be doing it on the finance side. It's just having that perspective of I'm not a marketer and getting someone who knows probably what is going to work and not work to then test better ideas. It's just a more efficient way to spend time and capital because I'm not just like throwing things at a wall. I have that extra layer of knowledge who's vetting our content strategy before we're doing things. So it was really founder-led. I'm still doing that, but having someone else also, you know, working on SEO, thinking about our like paid ad strategy, content on YouTube, spreading out our channels, just really having someone that's willing to push us and challenge, you know, what I was doing and saying, how can we make this better and how can we expand this?
Okay. So I think I'm looking at your Twitter here, Devin J. O'Brien, right?
Is that it? Yes.
Yeah. And so I guess So I see here a lot of long form content. So, you know, most people think, including me, think Twitter is just for telling people what I've had for breakfast. But you've taken a business approach, let's say a LinkedIn strategy, and yes. put it on top of Twitter, which is a little bit counterintuitive. And now you've got the 7,000 followers. And I guess what makes sense is there's a lot of the B2B content out there is vapid and empty for the most part. It's just written by a marketer who barely knows what they're talking about. Let's face it, you can spot it straight away.
Okay. Exactly.
Yeah. And were you not? Were you? I'm always afraid of like the emperor's new clothes, like someone catching me out. Well, if I want to, like, was there an imposter syndrome style where you're saying, I hate giving people advice on Twitter because, like, I know how hard it is, etc. Did you have to face that? Did you just say, "Damn it, I'm doing it anyway," or that was not a problem?
That was a good question. I think it's more of, I tried to stay away from the absolutes. I know that some people use the absolutes of this is how you do things, this is the right way. And that is like, you know, that can go viral. But to me, I didn't like want that, right? Like, I don't want to tell people how to do things and say this is the only way or this is the right way. Because let's face it, as I'm doing these tweets, I'm 30 years old. I don't know everything. And so for me, it was really just sharing case studies and learnings mostly and things that I see. So it was just really sharing like stories almost. And I didn't really care to apply it to everybody. I didn't care about the number of followers. I cared about who they were and the quality. Is it business owners? Is it other founders? Is it guys who are acquiring businesses that then could want to hire us on the accounting side? I really just wanted to go deep into showing the knowledge base from stories and experiences over this is how you do things, this is why, this is wrong, this is not. Because I, again, didn't care about getting everybody's attention. I wanted the right people's attention.
To sum up the learning, let's say, if we can, you weren't afraid to post. You told stories, not giving out opinions, which is my bugbear, which is the typical marketer thing, right? Telling them, telling people, you know, it's your 7 steps to business success and all that. And these these tweets are fairly substantial. Do you like block it out and say, I'm going to spend an hour on a tweet? Or does it just come out of you? You know, you're thinking about it all the time and it comes out, or are you more?
Yeah, it's a mix of both. I find sometimes like at night, I'm just sitting there and I'll go to my notes app and I'll write some idea I have. But what I usually end up doing is kind of on like a Sunday, I really like, I think with writing and being in the flow state's important. I block out a time and I always try to do it on the weekend when I know I'm not like going to have emails, phone calls, emails, text messages, Slacks, everything kind of going on. And I just know I can be in silence. And I think of like a different things that have happened. And I really just start with like a blank Google Doc and say like, here's what happened. And then I just start writing in just not editing. I'm just writing paragraphs or really long form content of like what happened, my learnings from it. And I don't really care what it looks like, right? I'm just really getting it all out there. And then from there, I format it and then I'm putting it into bullets. I'm erasing it, editing it. So it's really like either just short form tweets or things that I've seen that come to me at night. And then for long form, it's really just sitting down, going through things that have happened, things we've seen, strategies we've used, putting them down and then just really writing all of my thoughts and learnings from it and then putting it into readability or, you know, something that can be consumed on something like X.
Okay. So you're intentional. It's not just I started Twitter and this happened and I got a whatever, 9-figure business.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Last one on Twitter then. Who do you recommend to follow in that world?
So as far as finance or as far as just growth on Twitter?
Let's go for finance.
So I think there's a few different people. I think there's, I really like Sahil Bloom. I brought him up. I think he really was one of the first people who, he worked in private equity. Then he started posting on Twitter really a lot about long form learnings and kind of explaining finance concepts. You know, we love in finance to, you know, use big words that make it seem like, you know, I think back to the financial crisis, all the different terms that they tried to use to just say, we take a bunch of junk bonds and throw them in and make them an asset. That's what we do in finance. So he really was just dumbing it down and kind of explaining it in layman terms. So I think he's a really good one. You mentioned Alex Tremonti. I think his content is great. And I think those two really, when you see what they tweet, how they tweet, long form, short form, they're very intentional about it, right? And I think if you look at two people who have built massive followings, those guys really understand the algorithm. They understand how to do it. They reply to other people's tweets. I think those are like two of the best examples of people on X that if you model the things they do, you know, that really is who I originally was looking at when I had my X strategy in mind.
Awesome. So people can obviously get in touch with you on Twitter. How else do you like them to get in contact? I believe you have a template that might be useful for you work with e-commerce companies in particular. Is that right?
We do. Yeah. So I sometimes tweet out and I have a lot of SaaS, e-commerce, different templates and Excel models that I think could be beneficial to anybody. So Twitter's a great way, sending DMs or just Devin@Cortis.io. You can shoot me just a cold email, respond to everything, read everything. So really either there or X is you'll hear from me in 24 hours.
Very good. Well, thanks for coming along, Devin. I'll just ask you the ultimate question, which is to finish it up, who's your business hero? And
yes, my business hero is actually Mark Laurie. Are you familiar with Mark Laurie?
No, not at all. It's a new one.
Yeah, Mark Laurie, he's an entrepreneur. He started Jet.com, Diapers.com. And so he's actually from the area I'm from. He built two large businesses. One he sold to Walmart, one he sold to Amazon. And then he became an investor. And so he really started from, he was working in a large finance job. I think he was coming from either investment banking or sales and trading at a very big firm, kind of similar to Jeff Bezos at D.E. Shaw. He took a risk, decided he was going to go for it, got some capital from, you know, people that he had worked with in his banking job, and then really just didn't care about what anybody thought about being safe and that security. And he went for it and he's had massive success. And just on top of that, he then was posting and was actually, you know, active on X. And a couple of years back, I think it was in 2021 or 2022, I, you know, came across him, started following him, saw the success he had. And then I just actually cold reached out to him on X and he invited me over and let me spend a day with him, watching everything he does, his calls, talking about business. Wow. And I, someone who's, you know, he now part owns a basketball team, an NBA basketball team, has, you know, a VC firm, has had multiple successes, kids, everything. He has so much going on in his life. It was like, he's done all of this, started from the ground, built it all, massive success. But then someone who also still has time to make some random person on Twitter that reached out to him to spend a day with him, talk. And honestly, couldn't have been a better human being, couldn't have been nicer, and let me be involved and engaged with everything he did that day. So from potential investments to like things that most people would be sign an NDA, do all this, nothing. And then right after it, you know, I was leaving, Mark said, if you ever need anything, always reach out to me. And I just thought that type of person, you know, it's like, you see them in that like almost like glass house of they built this, they're a billionaire, but then they could come down and you realize that they are just a very humble, genuine human being. It was really an incredible experience. And so, yeah, Mark Laurie would be my business hero.
Awesome story. I mean, I like the local hero aspect of that because it sometimes makes it more relatable. You especially, I want to say, over here in Europe, it's easy to hear about another Yank making $1 billion, you know, but like it's not necessarily relatable. But if you're people around the corner from you that you see, okay, two arms, two legs, and they've got there, that's awkward. Why can't I get there? But when he invited you, how does that work? When you say spend the day with me, were you like sitting at the back of the conference room? Were you like, coffee? I don't know. What did that mean? Was it not super awkward?
It was crazy. He reached out to me and then he connected me with his assistant and his head of PR and was like, share some dates. I was living outside of New York City. So he just said, here's the address to the penthouse in New York and this time. So I just showed up. I came up the elevator with his private chef. And so we first just started with, we met, we talked about things, what I was doing. And then, you know, we just actually were in his house, like upstairs, either outside, inside, all day in the summer in New York City. And really just was like, he's just taking calls, videos, Zooms from his phone. And so it was like, we'd eat, he'd have a Zoom call, we'd listen, then we'd like debrief after it. So I was literally just in his house, hang out with him, eating with him, and just being involved in all of his calls from his house that entire day.
Wow, amazing. What an amazing opportunity. I love it. Yeah. I feel simultaneously super awkward and love to do it at the same time.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. When I first got there, I'm like, he knows nothing about me. I know really nothing about him other than what I've read on Google. Definitely felt awkward. And I don't like awkward. I definitely felt awkward in the beginning, but he made it like so comfortable and like just so, it just made it feel like it was normal that what we were doing. And it was just so cool. I couldn't really describe it. It was amazing.
Listen, Devin, I can foretell a career in teaching, professorial future maybe. You're a great communicator, and you've been very generous with being transparent about how you've had your success so far. I would be very fascinated to check in a couple of years, see where you go next. And thank you for coming along, and thank you for listening to the Gross Profit Podcast. We've got a name check today for one of our customers, D.E. Shaw. They use us to control spend in Manhattan. Very nice offices. They invited me to once there. And if you want to learn more about how you can use Procurement Express to control spend in your business, in the story today, we heard about ramp.com and using Mercury. In a very similar way, we are often used between bill.com, QuickBooks, and Procurement Express to control spend within an organization. And you can go to procurementexpress.com/partners to see a webinar all about that, as well as my take on how to explain the value of a fractional CFO in a way that CEOs will listen to. So thanks for listening. And Devin, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, James.